So once again, and welcome to the Accessibility Online webinar. Today we are focusing on accessible courthouses. Our moderator for today's session is Earlene Sesker from the U.S. Access Board. Earlene, you have the microphone.
Good afternoon, everyone, and I too would like to welcome you to our webinar series, where the topic for today will be accessible courthouses, and your presenter today will be Dave Anchulas. For those of you that follow our webinars, you are familiar with Dave. For those that aren't, I will let you know briefly a little bit of information about Dave. Dave is one of my most dependable and best speakers here for any of our trainings, both webinar and in-person trainings. He has been with the Access Board for 25 plus years and still going strong. He led the Accessible Courthouse Committee when we were doing the rules for courthouses and detention centers and so forth. So you have someone that has a wealth of knowledge about the subject, and he is going to be speaking to you today. And with that said, I will turn it over to Dave.
Thanks, Earlene, and thank you everybody for joining us. Earlene, I hope I could live up to the spin in that introduction, but I'll do my best. Moving on to slide 12, I'd like to just lay out what we're going to cover today in explaining accessible courthouses. We're going to start out with a discussion of entrances, working our way into a courthouse, and what some of the barriers and access solutions that are applicable. As you might expect, we're going to devote the vast majority of our time on accessibility of courtrooms, which have posed some of the most significant challenges to accessibility. And then after that, we're going to move on to some other areas in courthouses, such as holding cells, judges' chambers, jury deliberation rooms. So that'll be the topics we cover today. What I'd like to do on the next slide, 13, is just recap the basis for this webinar and the standards we'll be speaking about. They would include, of course, standards issued under the Americans with Disabilities Act, or ADA. These standards, the ADA standards, cover state, local, county government. They also cover private sector entities, specifically places of public accommodation and commercial facilities. And the current edition of the ADA standards is the one implemented by the Department of Justice in 2010 that would be applicable to all facilities covered by the ADA, except public transportation facilities, which are subject to standards implemented by the Department of Transportation. Now, the ADA and its standards are enforced by the Department of Justice, for the most part, or Department of Transportation if it concerns a transit system or facility, or the courts, because the ADA as a civil rights law is giving people the right to sue in federal court where discrimination is encountered based on disability. Now, we're also going to be speaking about standards issued under the Architectural Barriers Act and the ABA, which predates the Americans with Disabilities Act by over two decades, is focused on requiring access to facilities that are built, designed, or altered with federal monies, or leased by federal agencies. So federal courthouses, for example, would be subject to the Architectural Barriers Act and its standards, while state, local, or county courthouses would be subject to the ADA standards. Now, it's important to keep in mind that the Architectural Barriers Act could actually overlap and cover some areas subject to the ADA where federal funding is present. So, for example, if a state or local courthouse were designed or built with federal money or altered with federal money, it could well be covered by the ABA in addition to the Americans with Disabilities Act. Just something to keep in mind. Now, the ABA and its standards are actually enforced by the Access Board. The board, that's the one enforcement role the board has, is enforcing the standards of the ABA. We do so basically through complaint resolution and investigating complaints that are filed with the agency. They are handled by our Office of Compliance and Enforcement. So that process is quite different than the one under the ADA. Now, we did get a question in advance of today's webinar asking where access issues or complaints should be addressed. So it's important to consider the different means under each of these laws. If there's an access issue related to courthouses in a state or local courthouse, to pursue it under the ADA, one would be well advised to raise the issue with whoever is responsible for the facility. Also, public entities with 50 or more employees must have an official designated to handle ADA issues, often known as an ADA coordinator. And so one could also, if in their in the area they're in, they could raise the issue with their appropriate ADA coordinator. Now, the other option would be to file suit, or you could file a complaint with Department of Justice under the ADA. Now, on the Architectural Barriers Act side, of course, if it's a federal courthouse or it's one that could have been federally funded, so it doesn't, you know, if one is concerned about a state or local county courthouse, they could still file a complaint with the board under the Architectural Barriers Act if there's an access problem. We do investigate complaints. Complainants remain, their identity remains confidential, and we would proceed to open a case and determine whether, if it were a non-federal courthouse, we would do some investigating and determine whether federal funds were present and whether the ABA applied and take it from there. So those would be the options that one could take to pursue any kind of corrective action. Slide 14. Now, courthouse accessibility has historically been a problem and challenge because the type and nature of the facility, the fact that you have a lot of small elevated spaces and other factors have led to access problems. Also kind of aggravating this is the fact that too often in the design of facilities, accessibility was treated as an afterthought or something that was tacked on at later stages. And what is pretty clear from experience, both with courthouses and design and construction in general, is it's critical that accessibility be integrated into all stages of design, that it be baked in, if you will, so that it is achieved more seamlessly and efficiently. And in courthouses, a lot of times in the design of courthouses, there'll be actually mock-ups created in the design to verify sight lines and other factors. And this is a critical stage too for also testing accessibility. Also, what we found too is that accessibility can be achieved without impacting or compromising other design requisites, including those for security, sight lines, which are critical within courtrooms, and other necessities. Slide 15. A lot of what I'll be talking about today is based not only on the ADA and ABA standards, but also guidance, additional guidance we developed through an advisory committee. This was known as the Courthouse Access Advisory Committee. It was organized back in 2004 and had a two-year term, during which it met regularly and looked at, reviewed the standards, toured courthouses around the country, identified problems, common errors, conflicts or how they can be addressed, areas that were not being properly handled in design, common errors, and developed guidance on the best way to achieve accessibility so that access could be incorporated most effectively and successfully into the design of courthouses or into the alteration of existing courthouses. The committee had 35 members that included representation from various groups, disability groups, code groups. It also included courthouse designers and architects, court administrators, judges, and we also had some government agencies, including the General Services Administration, which is involved in the design of federal courthouses, as well as the Administrative Office of the U.S. Courts. Slide 16. The resulting report, the culmination of this committee's work, was a set of recommendations issued back in November of 2006. And what this report does is it provides guidance on how to meet the standards and specific provisions for courthouses. It also covers best practices. So the ADA and ABA standards are setting a minimum and don't necessarily get at the optimum level of accessibility. So this report includes best practices that go above and beyond some of the minimum requirements of the standards for better access. And it also identifies common errors that occur in the design of courthouses. Now, the one question we got about addressing access concerns seemed to indicate, too, that sometimes in their experience when they brought up issues to responsible officials, they seemed to suggest that they encountered some skepticism on the access issue until things were confirmed, say, with a call to the Access Board. If you are trying to convey some kind of access problem and someone is not really recognizing it as such, this committee report, as well as the standards themselves, would be good information to cite or share to indicate or prove that there is an access issue. Slide 17. We're going to move on now and review some of the requirements in the standards that are applicable to entrances, including those that serve courthouses. Slide 18. Entrances and the minimum number are addressed in the standards in Section 206.4. In the ABA standards, it's the same citation, but it's preceded by an F 206.4. And these standards require that at least 60% of public entrances be accessible. In addition, we also address and have specific requirements for access to entrances that serve direct connections from parking structures, as well as those serving elevated walkways or underground tunnels between buildings. In addition, restricted entrances, at least one must be accessible. Now, a restricted entrance is one that's for common use, not public use, and is basically available on a controlled basis, meaning that there is entry is verified and controlled by security or other personnel. One's identification is verified. So this kind of entrance, which we scopes separately just to make sure that access is covered here. When you have any, which they're pretty common at facilities like courthouses, at least one must be accessible. And then if you also have an entrance specifically or sally port for detainees or inmates, then that too would be another type that has to, at least one has to be accessible. Slide 19. Now, in addition to all the criteria and the standards for entrances and doors, which cover clear width, hardware, et cetera, the committee, our courthouse committee, in its report also addressed some best practices. And some of them include the fact that it's best at the entrance to design courthouse to minimize the elevation. Older courthouse design usually had the entry level elevated to to look with columns and have a more monumental appearance. But that would also would necessitate then lengthy ramps for entry. And so designs that minimize the elevation also facilitate access by allowing for shorter or ramps, or in some cases eliminating the need for a ramp. Also, we would advise that the primary entrance to facilities, including courthouses, be made accessible. There's not a specific mandate in the scoping for entrances that they be the primary entrance, but that would be beneficial. Also, we would say that because entry doors at court facilities often can be heavy, they should be automated. Now, doors in general are subject to a 5-pound maximum opening force, but that is not applied to exterior swing doors. So wherever we recommend that entry doors in general, but especially in courthouses, be automated for easier access. And one thing to keep in mind with federal courthouses is that the General Services Administration, in its public building standards, which apply to federal courthouses, does in fact mandate automation of accessible entrances. So if you're dealing with a federal courthouse, there actually would be a requirement for the automation of doors. Now, I think when I was mentioning the committee report, I did not note its availability on the board's website, but I would like to just note it now. And that report you could access on the board's website at access-board.gov/CAAC. That stands for Courthouse Access Advisory Committee. Slide 20. Now, another feature that's common at courthouses are bollards and other type of security barriers. And these elements cannot obstruct the accessible route. There's a specific provision in the standards prohibiting any kind of reduction in the clear width of accessible routes by such elements. So it's important that where your accessible route is configured, that these type of bollards or barriers not encroach on the minimum clear width. Slide 21. Now, in addition, the security screening that is often found at courthouses cannot obstruct the accessible route. Now, sometimes because of the type of equipment, it's necessary that the accessible route bypass screening devices. So you must maintain an accessible route, but it is permitted to go around certain devices. It's important, though, when there is an alternative route, that it be configured so that users are able to maintain an equal level of visual contact with personal items being screened or searched. Slide 22. Another feature of accessible entrances, specifically restricted entrances, would be if there's a two-way communication device provided, that it have visible and audible signals for accessibility. And this also applies not only to the entrance to the building, but also to entrances within the building to a secured area. So it's important that they have these features so that they're accessible to everybody. Also, if there's a provision that if there's a handset associated with the communication device, that it has a cord at least 29 inches long for access. Slide 23. Now, there are some exceptions for doors that manual doors that are operated only by security personnel. And in the standard, there's an exception that says that provisions for hardware, closing speed of door, and the opening force do not need to be met so long as the door is operated only by security personnel. If there is some kind of use beyond that, then it must fully comply. If the door is automated, then the provisions for clear width and threshold in the automated door section would be the only ones that are applicable. Slide 24. We're going to move on to a discussion of courtrooms, and we're going to first talk about which courtrooms or how many have to be accessible. Then we're going to move on and go element and space by element and space to look at how access is applied and can be met. Slide 25. In new construction, under the ADA and ABA standards, all courtrooms must be accessible and fully compliant with the standards. In an existing building that is altered, then the standards would apply to each altered courtroom. So it would depend on the scope of the alteration to determine which courtrooms are covered in the case of an alteration. Keep in mind, too, that a courtroom is a primary function area. And so when you alter a primary function area under these standards, you also must, as part of that work, provide an accessible path of travel to the extent its cost is not disproportionate. So that would be triggered, too, in the case of alterations occurring to an altered courtroom. Now, today's webinar is focused on the ADA and ABA standards, and they're applicable in new construction and alterations. But keep in mind that under laws like the ADA, there are provisions that are still relevant to existing facilities that are not being altered. And that would be, for example, the requirement for program access, under which a program must operate to accommodate people with disabilities in existing facilities. And that program access obligation could very well and often does necessitate retrofits to existing facilities. But this requirement is addressed in regulations issued by the Department of Justice under the ADA, not the ADA standards. And there are similar obligations for program access in the federal sector that would be applicable and enforced by the appropriate federal agency. Now, we did get a question in advance of this webinar about the claims that might be made when alterations are made to a historic facility and whether there's any kind of basis for departure because the facility is historic. The standards recognize or provide certain exceptions for historic facilities, but they have to be qualified historic facilities. That means they're listed or they're eligible for listing in the National Register of Historic Places, or they're designated as historic under appropriate state or local law. So first, in order any kind of basis of departure would be limited to qualified facilities. Secondly, if there's any kind of conflict, it really has to be based on compliance with the standards, threatening or destroying the historic integrity or significance of the facility. And that is a determination that has to be made by the appropriate State Historic Preservation Official or Advisory Council on Historic Preservation. So this is not something, this is not a determination that can be made just casually. It has to be backed up by applicable State Historic requirements and determinations. Now the standards do have some specific exceptions where this type of issue is encountered, where compliance would threaten or destroy the historic significance. And these address requirements for entrances and accessible routes and toilet rooms. But there also could be some other conflicts addressed and be the basis of departure under technical infeasibility in alterations. Slide 26. Now, the areas we're going to look at today within courtrooms would include, if we work our way from the outside, the entrances to the courtroom and signage, as well as seating in the gallery for the public. We also look at key components of courtrooms, including the litigant tables and lecterns, the jury box, the witness stand, as well as judges' bench and clerk stations. Slide 27. The entrance to courtrooms, we're looking at compliance with all applicable criteria for doors. This would be found in Section 404 of the standards. This would include the 5-pound maximum opening force for doors. If a door by its design, weight, or other factor is not going to open within the 5 pounds, then as an interior door, it must be automated. So that would be important, and it's an important difference from an exterior swing door. Also, slide 28. There's a provisions in the door section that cover the height of vision panels or vision lights in or aside doors, which are quite common at courtrooms. And if they're provided, we don't require vision lights, but if they're provided, the viewing panel must be, the bottom edge can be no higher than 43 inches above the finished floor. This is true to the extent that the bottom edge is no higher than 66 inches, which would indicate that if it's that high, it's not really being provided to look through. Slide 29. The standards also address doors in series, and many courtrooms have an entry vestibule with a pair of doors or doors in series, and we just wanted to note and call that out as a requirement wherein you must have a minimum 4-foot separation between the swing of both doors in series. This is required so that people with disabilities, including those using wheeled mobility aids, can get clear of one door and its swing before encountering the next, because otherwise it's very difficult to have one door open and then begin the process of opening a second door simultaneously. Slide 30. I did want to call out two requirements applicable to signs, because this is an area where we get quite a few questions, especially related to which signs must be tactile. And the way the standards apply, they require that signs identifying permanent rooms and spaces, and that would include courtrooms, it would include restrooms, jury assembly rooms, et cetera, they must be raised and brailled and also comply with the visual requirements. Also, room and floor numbers or letters are also required to be both tactile and visual. And also, we require doors at exit stairways, exit passageways, and exit discharge to be labeled by tactile and visual signs as well. So at a minimum, these type of signs must be both tactile and visual. Slide 31. Now, there are a number of different types of signs that are covered and subject to the requirements to be visual, but they're not required to be tactile and have the raised or braille characters. These would include signs providing direction to or information about interior spaces and facilities. And examples would include something like a sign that says restricted court staff only, that's an instructional sign, or a directional or instructional, like in the case of fire, use stairs, a directional sign indicating the elevators and using an arrow would be one that's as directional, only required to be visual, as would a sign saying no cell phone use, please. And these signs are just examples of types that must meet the visual criteria but not required to be tactile. And on slide 32, there's actually various classes of signs that are exempt entirely. These would include temporary signs, Building addresses and directories are exempt, as are occupant names, company names and logos, seat and road designations and assembly areas. Also, we exempt signs in the non-public areas of detention and correctional facilities, and also menus. Slide 33 shows a sample sign for a courtroom, and the sign says courtroom 304, and then below that it notes Honorable Jane Smith presiding, and then it says no cell phone use. This type of sign actually has a couple separate different features subject to different requirements in the standards. Courtroom 304 as a permanent room identification label would have to be raised and brailled as well as visual. So braille is shown below that raised text indicating courtroom 304. Now the presiding judge's name as an occupant, that's exempt, so it doesn't have to comply. Compliance is advisable, at least with the visual, but it's not required. And then the language concerning no cell phone use would be considered informational, and that portion would, at a minimum, have to be meet the visual requirements for characters. So that's how the different requirements would apply into this example courtroom sign. Slide 34. Moving on to the gallery of the courtroom, the standards require wheelchair spaces according to the total seating capacity in an assembly with fixed seating. The table starts out that for assembly areas with 4 to 25 seating capacity, one wheelchair space is required. Two is required for with a capacity of 26 to 50. And then 51 to 150 capacity, four spaces are required. And then 151 to 300, five. And then the standards further address, the table further addresses larger seating assemblies, but it basically with courtrooms we're seeing most seating capacities being within these numbers. We did get a question about if you have, say, pew-style bench seating in the gallery, how you calculate seating capacity. And basically the building codes typically have a minimum space allocation for the capacity. Usually, I think it's somewhere in the range of like 18 to 22 inches would account for each space. So that, or whatever is found in the applicable building code can be used to determine the actual capacity in that type of seating design. Slide 35. Now here on this slide is being depicted a gallery seating with four wheelchair spaces that are along the aisle. Now it's important that the wheelchair space be integrated and located within the seating footprint. Your wheelchair spaces cannot overlap circulation paths, nor can they encroach into the main aisle or the minimum width required by the building or life safety code for the aisle. Now, it's also the size too of these spaces is determined by the approach direction. So those that are entered from the side, as shown here, will need to be at least 6 inches long to accommodate the maneuvering into the space. It's also important, and the advisory committee's report recommends that these spaces be designed and located, and the access, the aisle access way between rows be sized so that a person using the wheelchair space doesn't have to move from the row to allow access for others in the same row. Slide 36. Now, this is a depiction of the size requirements for the wheelchair space in assembly areas based on whether it's the approach. If you enter from the front or the back, the space must be at least 36 inches wide and at least 48 inches long. If it's entered from the side, then, as I noted, the length is at least 36 inches, or excuse me, is at least 60 inches long, and is at least 36 inches wide. And so this is length accommodates the right angle turning into the space from the side. Slide 37. Also, among the requirements for wheelchair spaces is a provision that ensures that the wheelchair space be located to provide shoulder-to-shoulder alignment with adjacent seating in the row. So this is determined by the center line measured from 36 inches from the front of the space. And that's what you use to base the alignment of the adjacent seating for shoulder-to-shoulder alignment. Slide 38. Another feature common to courtrooms are gates, which are usually there to separate the gallery from the well of the court. Now, the courthouse committees recommended that you not provide any gates for easier access. So the best thing to do is to avoid a gate. If you do provide a gate, then it does have to fully comply with our requirements for doors and gates. And we would also advise that the gate should extend closer to floor level so that one could push it open with footrests on their way in as an option. Slide 39. Other requirements for gates would include that at least one lease have a clear width of at least 32 inches. We also require a smooth surface on the push side that is within 10 inches of the floor. Also, the opening force, like doors, is 5 pounds maximum. And we also address closing speed, including for gates with spring hinges. And the hardware would also have to comply. Slide 40. Now, moving on to the jury box and witness stand, we have requirements that address access to make sure that you have clear floor space, wheelchair space within the defined area, both of the jury box and the witness stand. Removable seats are permitted when the space is not needed for access. It's important, too, that any enclosure or gates to these spaces provide unassisted or independent access. If they're raised, then a ramp is required, or you are permitted a lift as an option, but they must be permanent. And also, we don't permit portable solutions like fold-out or telescoping ramps in new construction or alterations. There may be some possibility in an existing facility as a retrofit for access. But in new construction or alteration, the solution, vertical access solution, must be permanent. Also, if the space is served by a ramp or a lift with an entry ramp, then we require turning space within that area. Now, we did get a question about if you have a single riser to an elevated space, like a jury box or a clerk station, does that count as a stair? And we would advise that, yes, under codes, a single step, if it's part of a means of egress, is typically covered as a stair. But we are also aware, too, that some of these spaces that utilize a lift to elevate the entire area are pursuing some provisions in the building code to provide alternative handholds in case of lifts. Slide 41. Now, the clear floor space required in the in the jury box or witness stand is specified as being at least 30 inches by 48 inches for a forward approach. And if the space is confined for more than half the depth on the sides, meaning it's recessed or surrounded on both sides more than 24 inches, then the 30-inch width actually is increased to 36 inches to allow more room for maneuvering into the space. So that's where the space is obstructed on three sides, including both sides more than half the depth. Slide 42. If you have a side approach into the clear floor space, then we're seeing the same length that we saw for the wheelchair space in the assembly, it being at least 60 inches long to accommodate the maneuvering into the space. Now, this applies in the case of this type of clear floor space when it's surrounded on three sides, including both the front and back, by more than 15 inches or half the width. Slide 43. Now, these clear floor spaces, if there's any kind of fixed element at them, like a ledge or millwork, there must be knee and toe clearance maintained. So, for example, at a kind of ledge, say, that overlap the clear floor space, you would have to have the appropriate clearance and knee clearance depending on how far the projection is. Slide 44. This slide is showing you in profile the minimum clearances for knees and toes. Now, basically, if we work from the leading edge of the clear floor space, we require at least a 9-inch minimum clearance for toes that extends 6 inches. At that point, the clearance must increase from the 9-inch height to a 27-inch height for knees, and this must occur over a 3-inch span, horizontal span, and then the remainder of the clear floor space, knee space, must provide the 27-inch clearance for knees. So that is, in quick summary, the profile of the knee and toe space that's required for any clear floor space where there's any fixed element overlapping it, the front of it. Slide 45. Now, with jury box and witness stands, it's important that the necessary access be permanent. It's important, too, that the clear floor space be within the defined area. Now, there is one exception, specific to alterations, under which if the necessary ramp or lift to a jury box or witness stand would obstruct a means of egress, then only in that condition would we permit the wheelchair space to be located outside the defined area. And also, in qualified historic facilities, departures may also be possible where they would compromise or threaten or destroy the historic integrity of the facility in providing the vertical access to these kind of spaces. Slide 46. This slide is showing a jury box. Now, in this example, we see that the first row of the box is at floor level, so that obviates the need for any kind of vertical access. And in this case, we see that the wheelchair space, clear floor space, is entered from the side, so that's requiring that 60-inch minimum length for the space. And providing the wheelchair space at floor level is going to provide the easiest access. Slide 47. But we understand, of course, that for sight lines and other features, the preference may be to raise the jury box, including the first tier. And here on this slide, we see an example of the first tier raised, that one riser that's served by a ramp. And the space is located, the wheelchair space is located in the first tier, so it's accessible at that level. And there's a turning space available within this area because it is served by a ramp. This ensures that one has room to turn around to go back down the ramp, because we don't want anyone having to enter a space by a ramp and not having enough room to turn around and go back down the ramp. Slide 48. This is showing the same configuration, but it's just making the point that in this instance, your turning space and your clear floor space serving the jury box could overlap. But that's true as long as it's not serving other locations such as the witness stand, because then you'd want turning space available for users of the witness stand. Slide 49. Now, the turning space that's required can be provided in one of two ways. It's either a 60-inch minimum diameter circle or a T-shaped space with overall dimensions of 60 inches by 60 inches, and basically ensuring that each section of the T is at least 3 feet wide. Slide 50. Now, in the example of a ramp serving a jury box or witness stand, if the rise is no higher than 6 inches, handrails aren't required. But if the rise is greater than 6 inches, handrails must be provided on both sides. Also, we address, of course, the maximum slope of 1 to 12, the cross slope. The minimum clear width of ramps is 36 inches, and that is measured between the leading edge of handrails where provided. Also, ramps must have a landing that's at least 60 inches long, both at the top and bottom, and that's as wide as the ramp itself. Slide 51. This is showing an example. This is something that we saw in some of the courthouses we looked at, where the access to the jury box was provided at the front of the box by a gate, an entry gate. In the front, the first row is at floor level, so basically one would have to swing open the gate and then proceed back into the space. Now, this type of design poses issues of usability, because basically it's one where one has to open a gate and then proceed into the space. And on slide 52, we see that a lot of these designs, it's really not allowing for independent access. First off, what we noticed were a lot of these designs weren't compliant because they didn't have the opening force. They didn't meet the 5-pound opening force because they were matching the millwork and were quite thick. And also, it's difficult to close it back once one has proceeded into the space. So this type of design is not really advisable or possibly compliant. So we don't encourage it. Slide 53. Moving on to witness stands. Like we saw with the jury box, a witness stand at floor level is going to provide the easiest access. But if it is raised, then on slide 54, we would encourage that access be provided by a ramp instead of a lift, because it's generally preferred and more convenient. Slide 55. Now, with the witness stand, we see the same requirements we saw for the jury box with the clear floor space. And then if you have any kind of counter or any overlap, the knee and toe space must be provided. Also, turning space is required in the raised area, as it would be by a if the area were served by a lift with an entry ramp. Slide 56 shows us the provision of the turning space, in this case the T-shaped space, being available to serve the raised witness stand. Slide 57. Now, I mentioned that ramps are preferred over lifts, and the reason for this is that most users prefer ramps. They're more reliably independently used. They're less conspicuous. We do require that the lifts be independently operable, but still, it's just that with the ramp solution, there's less maintenance, and so their operation and use is more reliable. So these are just some of the reasons why we generally advocate or prefer ramps over lifts. But in the case of the raised areas within courtrooms, the jury box, witness stand, and some others we'll talk about, the lift is permitted as an option. Slide 58. Now, if you do use platform lifts for access to the raised areas of courtrooms, it's important that often they involve custom design. There's no standard design for the courtroom lifts. Also, it's usually critical to coordinate the millwork and lift design for the insulation so that it's all properly worked out. As I noted, that lifts must be independently usable and can't involve assistance in their use. It's important, too, to factor in the necessary maintenance and repair of lifts. And we also make sure that the standards have specific requirements for lifts on Section 410, but they also reference the industry safety standard, the AFSCME A18.1 standard. Slide 59. Now, later editions of the AFSCME standard than those referenced in the ADA or ABA standards, starting with the 2008 edition of the AFSCME, include a new section specifically on courtroom lifts. But this version of the AFSCME standard isn't yet referenced by the ADA or ABA standards. slide 60. There are several different types of lift designs that are common in courtroom applications. They would include a cantilevered platform or screwdriver lift system. There's also electric or hydraulic scissor lift designs, or what is known as a four-cornered screwdriver lift. And some of these designs, too, are responsive to issues that came up in the past with more older technologies of lift. One thing we found and saw was that with lifts that were used to basically remain in an up position, for example, for the area of a witness stand, there were situations where either the platform would kind of deflect over time or sometimes not remain stationary as it was intended to, but so that there's been some improved designs in response to some of those issues. Slide 61 is, this slide is giving you an example of a type of lift design that's really this example of a lift providing the floor of the witness stand. And so in the normal position, it's there as the raised level of the witness stand. Then slide 62, when it is needed for access, it would close, the gate would close to the witness area, and there would also be a roll-up barrier for the stationary part of the witness stand, and then the lift would activate and proceed downward, and then the gate would open, and in slide 63, you see the entry ramped to the platform in the lowered position. Slide 64, this is showing the design where the lift is in mid-travel. This would be going from the witness stand floor up, and this design is not only serving the witness stand, but slide 65, it also proceeds to go up to and serve the judge's bench. Slide 66. Now, other courtroom stations addressing the standards would include work areas like judges' benches and stations for clerks, court reporters, and bailiffs. Now, we do require access to these areas, including compliant work surfaces. So that would mean that the work surface is accessible, has a knee and toe clearance, and wheelchair space, and a height between 28 to 34 inches. Also, vertical access to raised areas is required, but in the case of these stations, adaptability is permitted. I'm going to talk a little bit more about that. Slide 67. Now, what we mean by adaptability is we're saying that a ramp or lift can be installed after construction to provide vertical access to judges' benches, clerk stations, court reporter stations, so long as you have the necessary space, and in the case of lifts, the electrical service, to facilitate installation of the ramp or lift after construction. Now, some things to keep in mind is that this allowance for later installation is not permitted for jury boxes or witness stands. The only reason we're allowing it for these stations is because they are used by employees, and one would likely have more advanced notice of the need for access and could provide it more effectively in accommodating an employee, but it really wouldn't be workable in accommodating the access to jury boxes or witness stands, because you never really know day to day who may need access to those spaces. Also, this exception is recognized in later editions of the International Building Code starting in 2009, but not earlier editions. So that's just something to keep in mind if you are subject to an earlier edition of the IBC. Also, keep in mind that the ADA standards and the ABA standards do not supersede any state or local requirements or access codes. So make sure, too, that any applicable state or local codes aren't stricter on this point and potentially not allowing this adaptable access that these standards permit. Slide 68. Now, some best practices that were advised by our courthouse committee included that access be permanently built in to all of these courtroom stations in all courtrooms. So that the best thing to do would be to have built-in access in new construction to each of them. in all courtrooms. The other next below that, the next best alternative would be to have at least one of each type of courtroom have built-in access and then go with adaptable for the remainder. Because this is going to facilitate providing access in the future over the lifespan of the building as the need arises with these type of workstations in the courtroom. Slide 69. Some other best practice recommendations specific to the judge's bench would be that you provide ramp access instead of lift access for the same reasons we noted with respect to jury boxes and witness stands. Also, it would be best to make sure that that's built in instead of designed for later installation. Also, a good practice is to locate the ramp outside the courtroom, which affords greater security and decorum for the judge. Now, slide 70 is showing an example of a ramp and serving a judge's bench that's located behind a wall so that it's really not visible from the courtroom. And this one, this example is coming to us from the Ottawa County Courthouse in Grand Haven, Michigan. Slide 71. This is the same design, only a more aerial view, and you can see where the we're showing a ramp as it continues behind the wall and up to the judge's bench in a more discreet manner. Slide 72. This is an example of a lift serving a judge's bench, and it too is located behind a wall in the courtroom so that it's not visible from the courtroom. And so what we advise is that access should be provided so that the judge enters the room at the level, top level of the bench. Again, this allows for better security, safety, decorum. Now, slide 73 is a schematic that shows a courtroom with all of these features. Basically, it demonstrates that all the access requirements we talked of so far can be met with a courtroom and that's 2,400 square feet. And this one is showing a entry vestibule with double swing doors in series. It's showing you the necessary minimum 4-foot separation between the swing of those doors. We see a gallery area with, based on the capacity, it having at least 4 wheelchair spaces. This design, in the lower portion, you see the jury box that is raised, as is the witness stand. And both the first tier of the jury box and the witness stand are raised 6 inches and served by the same ramp. So one ramp is serving both spaces, and there's a turning space near that ramp that is also effectively serving both. Also, there's the clerk station and reporter station in front of the bench, and to the side of the judges, on the other side of the judge's bench, is also raised 6 inches and served by a separate ramp and turning space on the other side. Then we see that the judge's bench is raised 18 inches and has a ramp serving it. That's actually in the back corridor, so that there's actually an entrance from behind the bench past the ramp so that the judge would enter this courtroom at the level of the bench. And there's also a turning circle serving this bench as a separate raised area. Slide 74. Now, this is an example of a smaller courtroom, 1,800 square feet. which also has the double doors in series, the requisite separation between them, the four wheelchair spaces in the gallery. However, spaces for access is minimized by the jury, the first row of the jury box being at floor level, so that obviates the need for vertical access to the jury box. In this case, we see a witness stand raised 6 inches and served both by a turning circle and a ramp. Also, on the other side of the bench is a clip station that is raised 6 inches, also served by a ramp and turning circle. And like the prior example, this judge's bench is raised 18 inches and also served by a ramp that's outside the courtroom in the back corridor. Slide 75. Now, the standards apply to those elements that are fixed or built in. And so some elements like lecterns, compliance would be required only where it's fixed. However, we would advise that for movable furnishings that compliance also be achieved to ensure access in that instance as well. Now with lecterns, and to make sure that it's accessible as a work surface, the advisory committee we had also developed some additional recommendations on slide 76. These include that the adjustable surface height ranged from 28 inches, which is the minimum for access, up to 44 inches, which is more conducive for height for standees. We also would recommend that the angle of the work surface be adjustable to better accommodate different users. In addition, below the work surface, it's important to have the requisite knee and toe space for a forward approach access. And this is another critical factor, is that the top edge of the surface should adjust with the work surface itself, meaning that there's nothing really that remains stationary at the front of the lectern that would obscure the sight line when the adjustable surface is lowered. So basically, we want to try and provide clear sight lines from the work surface from whichever position it's in, is what that recommendation gets to. Slide 77. Another feature of courtrooms is required assistive listening systems. They're required in each courtroom. And these assistive listening systems basically improve the sound quality for people with hearing impairments. There are several different types of technologies for these systems, including infrared systems, loop systems, audio induction loop systems, and FM systems. Each type of technology has its pros and cons. With the case of courtrooms, in most cases, the infrared type of system works best because the infrared is better for providing access in spaces where confidentiality of conversation is important. So you could have bleed through or spillover with FM systems and sometimes even with loop systems. So that's why usually infrared assisted listening systems are used in courtroom applications. The standards also address other features of the system, the operating qualities, including signal to noise ratio and other aspects to ensure a clear and sufficient signal. Also, we address the number of receivers that are used, including a portion that must be compatible with people using hearing aids. And we also require signs indicating the availability of these systems that include a designated symbol, international symbol for access for hearing loss. Now, moving on from the courtroom site 78, we're going to touch on and recap some requirements that are applicable to other spaces in courthouses, including holding cells. Slide 79. The standards, the standards address both central and court floor holding cell areas. So whichever provider or both are provided, access is required to each. We also require access to at least one of each type, including by sex, male and female, and age, adult and juvenile. So if you have different cells serving different populations based on gender or age, access is required to at least one of each type. Also, it's important that each courtroom be served by at least one accessible cell. So if you have court floor holding areas, then we want to make sure that each courtroom is served by an accessible cell. Now, cells can serve more than one courtroom. So if you have a situation where you have paired cells serving two different courtrooms, then if that one cell that's accessible could serve both, then only one of that pair would need to be compliant. And on slide 80, some of the features of accessible holding cells would include compliant doors, although as I noted earlier, there are some exceptions where the door is operated only by security personnel concerning requirements for opening force, closing speed, and hardware. Also, accessible cells must have turning space. If benches are provided, we don't require, but if benches are provided, we address criteria for compliance of the bench. And we also require that toilet facilities serving accessible cells be fully compliant. Now, we don't specifically prohibit the combination toilet and lav that are often found in holding cells, but they must fully comply. So if you are using a combination unit in your accessible cell, it must be fully compliant. Otherwise, separate fixtures are necessary. Slide 81. A common question we get about accessible holding cells and toilets are options for grab bars, specifically where there's interest in trying to reduce suicide risks. Now, the Department of Justice has a guide on accessible cells in correctional facilities. It's available on DOJ's ADA website at ada.gov. And this guide indicates that certain features like infill plates can be possible so long as a grab bar is complying with all our criteria, including diameter, gripping surface, et cetera. So there can be options that can be pursued to minimize some of the risks. Slide 82. The standards also address access to visiting areas, serving cells. We require access to at least one counter on both the visitor and the detainee side if they're provided in the courthouse to serve holding areas. Cubicles, if they're provided, we require 5% to be accessible on both sides. This type of access must provide forward approach access. If partitions are provided, then we also, and are solid, we require means to facilitate voice communication, which could be done a number of ways through a grill, talk-through baffle, intercom system. If handsets are provided, then they must have a volume control as well. Slide 83. Some other areas of courthouses that are covered would include jury assembly rooms, jury deliberation rooms, judges' chambers, public restrooms. Many other areas in a courthouse are also going to be covered by the standards. So what we covered here today in this webinar is not exhaustive of all that is covered by the standards. Parking and, you know, other areas, cafeterias, lobbies, are all covered as well. But some of the things that we see in these areas that we'd like to just call out, we did get a question we asked that was asking about review of requirements for, say, something like jury rooms. If it's the jury assembly room, for example, if that is succeeding, that would have to comply as an assembly space. And also, if there's, it would also be subject to requirements for assistive listening systems as well, if audio amplification is provided. Also, with respect to jury deliberation rooms, requirements are going to apply based on what's provided. For example, if you have, say, restrooms individually serving the jury deliberation room or drinking fountains, then the requirements and the standards are going to apply based on what's provided. So if it's an element covered by the standards and it's provided to serve a jury deliberation room or some other area, then you would follow the basic scoping for that element. So, and that would be true for other areas, including restrooms would follow, be subject to the regular scoping for restrooms. I think some other questions we got in advance of the session. One asked, in an historic court facility, is it permissible for one to transport detainees with disabilities using freight elevators? And our answer is no, because typically using this standard freight elevator for passenger violates the elevator code as well as insurances. So it's not something that would seem an option, even in the case of historic facility.
Okay. With that said, Dave now has completed what he had prepared to share with you. Now he's going to, for the next 15 minutes or so, 10 minutes or so, try to answer some of the questions that have come in during the session.
Okay. One question we got was, and I think I overlooked the web address for the Courthouse Committee report and noted it later, but I do want to repeat it. For that courthouse report, you could find it on the board's website just by typing in www.accessaccess-board.gov/CAAC. And that should take you directly to that courthouse report. We also got a question about what is the minimum width between bollards when we were looking at entrances and the security bollards. It's the standard minimum clear width for continuous clear width for an accessible route, which means that an accessible route must have a continuous clear width of at least 3 feet. It is permitted to reduce to 32 inches at points like doorways or between bollards, so long as the reduction doesn't extend for a distance of more than 2 feet. So 36 inches or potentially 32 inches for a maximum distance of 2 feet. And there's a question about addressing assistive listening options in secured areas, for example, holding cells. The standards require the assistive listening system as part of design and construction in all courtrooms and as well as in other assembly areas equipped with audio amplification. If other areas, while you may not have a requirement in the standards for a built-in assistive listening system, under other obligations of the ADA, including effective communication, accommodation of people with disabilities, assistive listening systems, including may be necessary or be provided to serve other areas, but that would be something that could be done and provided operationally, not necessarily built in under the standards. Now, another question we got is there a requirement to provide signage if no signs are provided through the building other than restrooms and exits? No. In general, the ADA standards, other than certain required access symbols or the labeling of certain exits at exit passageways and exit discharge, in general doesn't require provisions of signs. So for the most part, the signage requirements apply where signs are provided. Another question we got was, this question says, if there was a courthouse was completed before the current ADA standards was issued and effective, and it has raised witness box and jury seating, but no access ramps, what retroactive provisions from current or prior standards can be enforced? Well, under the standards, we sought to make clear in the ADA accessibility guidelines these areas, like the witness stand and jury box, to make it clear. One of the other prior standards that was used earlier under the ADA, the Uniform Federal Accessibility Standard, was also interpreted as addressing certain areas of courthouses that could serve as a basis for access to them. But if we're talking about a facility that, say, predated the ADA and doesn't have access to witness box and raised jury boxes, then if it's altered, if these areas are altered, then they would have to comply with the current standard. And so as part of the alteration to a witness stand or jury box in an existing, they would have to comply. If the facility isn't altered, predates the ADA, then we're relying on the program access obligations of the law, in which case people must be accommodated because courtroom programs and services, like other programs and services of public entities, must accommodate people with disabilities to the extent it does not fundamentally alter the program or result in undue administrative or financial burdens. So that means that actions must be taken at the time. Generally, those actions should be building retrofits, but if they're not viable, then you would have to do other take other measures so that the program or service, including all the relevant court services, were accessible to people with disabilities. And that's in the case of a building that predated the ADA entirely. Another question we got is, if there are directional signs, say, to an elevator, how would they serve people with vision impairments if they're not tactile? The reason we limit the application of the tactile requirements to signs for print rooms and spaces and some of the others I mentioned is that we're basically trying to focus on signs that are typically located at a doorway because the doorway itself provides a tactile cue on where to locate the sign. Directional signs and other informational signs not labeling a room or space or exit can be located anywhere and as such are not then necessarily easily located by touch. So that's really the main reason why we limit the requirements for tactile raised and braille characters to certain categories of signs. Seeing some other questions that came in. One question we got is, can the 60-inch turning space be located at the top of a ramp? In the raised areas we spoke of, like the jury box and witness stand, for example, and some of the others, the turning space is not prohibited from overlapping the top landing at the ramp. Then there was another question, is there any concern with a witness sharing a ramp with jurors? Some designs are such that they try and maintain a separation between witnesses and jurors. And so if that's the case, and one does not want, say, one ramp to serve both the witness stand and jury box, then that's perfectly fine under the standards. You would just need to have individual ramps serving each area if the jury box is raised. The accessible portion of the jury box is raised, as is the witness stand. So there's no preference on the standards whether it's one or two separate ramps. But if that's the case and two are needed for different factors, then that would be permissible. And I think we have time only for one more. I'm just looking for one I think I could answer in the time remaining. One question we got was, please review adaptability again. Okay, well, with adaptability, keep in mind that that's permitted only for the workstations of the courtroom, meaning the judge's bench, the clerk station, bailiff station, court reporter. Secondly, that exception is permitted so long as you design it so that you have the space for the ramp that would be installed later, or you have the space and the electrical support for a lift if that's what's going to be installed. So those features that facilitate later installation are key to the adaptability. But keep in mind that that later installation of vertical access is not permitted in other areas of the courtroom. And it's important that we don't allow walls or anything else to be moved as part of that adaptation. It's something that must be designed so that it's there, the space is there, you have the space for the ramp or the lift and the electrical support, and no real further action is needed other than the ramp or lift installation itself.
Okay. With that said, that's all the time that we have today to share with you Dave's knowledge, his wealth of knowledge. I want to thank everyone again for joining us. And Claudia, turn it back over to you for the continuing education.
Thank you, Erin. Today's session has been approved for AIA credit. Our provider number is I017. After the session, if you are interested in requesting AIA certification, you could send your concerns and questions to certificates@adaconferences.org, and we'll address those, all your questions and concerns regarding certificate of attendance or AIA certificates. If you have any follow-up questions for the Access Board, you can email them at ta@access-board.gov, or you can call their number, 800-872-2253, and you can follow up with any other questions regarding this topic through their 800 number. The next session is scheduled for August 3rd on the address surface roughness and rollability research. If you want to register for that, you can visit our website at accessibilityonline.org. I want to thank everyone, thank our presenters for today's session. To exit the webinar platform, you can click the X in the upper right-hand corner. For the phone, you can just disconnect. That concludes today's presentation. Thank you and have a good day.